Pod. 22 grand. Pod. In the city that sounds nice. Huh. Yeah, I mean, I'm loving the background. There's both platinum discs, are they, for the Strux?
I don't even know. Maybe okay. Gold or, I don't, maybe platinum. I got them a long time ago.
Yes, and you're only up in Hebden Bridge, is that right?
That's right, West Yorkshire.
And what kind of drew you there?
What drew me here was my best friend had kids, and we were living in Berlin for many years, like 15 years, and the kids didn't want to learn German, and because we didn't, and it was going to become a problem in school, so we needed to find someplace English-speaking, culturally interesting, and affordable to live, and only Hebden Bridge seemed to mark all of those little crosses.
Okay, great. Have you got like a studio in there where you still have bands and stuff?
I have been working out of Eiger Studio in Leeds whenever I record bands, but I have a couple different audio setups in my house for different projects. Like, I do a lot of mixing here, and I have a synthesizer composition room, and so there's lots of things that are done here. I think I mixed the Lounge Society here with the whole band in my living room. That was kind of fun.
Excellent. Yeah, I know some people, my friends... they asked me before I spoke to you if they, you said I'd put a word in for recording with Gordon. So I said maybe, because they live in Hull, which is not too far from Leeds.
Right. Yeah, I'm working with lots of local bands in the region, and it's really handy having this Eiger studio. It just seems to work well for recording rock and roll and live projects.
Okay, great. Yeah, well, I actually messaged you about 10 years ago about my... me and my friend were making some songs, and you sent a really nice reply, to be fair.
That's good.
And there was talk about maybe recording, but I think you were in Berlin at the time.
Yes, I was. And which group was it? Or
It's just me and my friend. Like, I think I just sent you on a whim. We didn't even have a band together. It was just me and him.
And did you send me music or just ask questions?
No, it's music. And you actually gave some feedback on each song and were pretty complimentary, which I was pretty happy with. But yeah,
you know, most people who send me music or want to work with me are fairly cool. I rarely get something that's completely wrong for me. I guess it's just my niche of what I'm doing. Just people who seem to know what they want and what they're doing seem to contact me.
Well, we don't really know what we're doing, but still. But yeah, I've been really enjoying your book over the last few days.
Thank you.
It's been really good. And I actually listened again to your... episode with the Strux, and just because, you know, obviously made a bit more sense now, the things you're talking about. But yeah, how was that as a process of writing the book? Did you find it quite cathartic, as people say when they write their own book?
I don't know if it was cathartic. It was highly satisfying, because as I kind of mentioned in that book, it's like everywhere I go for 20 years, everybody in the studio on a break asked me these certain questions, you know, like, what was it like? And, you know, were they really good? Or, you know, how did you get this sound? And so these were like songs I've sung for years. I knew them very well. And it was great putting them down in one place and double checking on the internet to make sure I had my timeline and some of my facts straight, you know.
Reading the book, I was introduced to people like Toby.
Yes.
At Transgressive, who I've since got in contact with, and hopefully going to get him on the podcast.
Very good. Yeah, he's a special, special soul.
And I'm right in thinking you're doing like some live events with him to promote the book.
We did the book launch at Rough Trade East in London. He was gracious enough to be my moderator and go on stage with me for an hour and a half and chat about our history and different things.
Ah, excellent. So how young was he when you met him?
I think he was 15.
Wow.
And this kid is in the book. The story of how I met him is in the book, and because it's so good. I'm at a big Stroke show, like one of the biggest they played in London at the time, right when the album hadn't even come out. It was just like the first single from Is This It? And Nick Valenci leads this 15-year-old kid through the crowd to meet me at the party afterwards. I'm thinking, who's this little high school kid? We call them high school in my country, so it looks like he's in high school. And then there's this guy following him. I go, that must be his dad. Like, what is going on here? And Toby shakes my hand and he says, I run a website. Would you like to write for me? I think 15-year-old kids asking me if I want to work for him and his website. I said, sure, I'll write for you. And that began like a long time partnership of club nights and consulting. He just is he was very precocious and bright and observant musically at an early age.
All right, yeah. I mean, yeah, the access that he got sounds amazing, so it'd be great to have a chat with him.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. I mean, he would just go up and knock on people's backstage door, and they'd think, what's this all about? And then the first question out of his mouth would convince them that he was really someone worth talking to.
Delving a bit into your history, like I read, you're saying that you were making music for adverts and actually Microsoft at one point. Something quite interesting.
At one point, I was in a very successful band during the grunge scene in Seattle, and that was a real highlight of my life in many ways. Touring, having an income based on playing music live, those were all great things. And after that kind of folded, after the grunge scene went down, a friend of mine from a studio was doing a lot of soundtrack work for Microsoft during their early days, like this is the late 90s still. And I got a couple chances to do some electronic music for them, yeah.
So did you actually hear some of your music on the television in the end, obviously?
No, I think we were on some CD-ROMs and some games, and I did an advertisement that was on TV with Matt Cameron from Soundgarden and Pearl Jam. He played drums with me. It was like a heavy metal thing I'd written.
All right, cool. And then there's a good story in the book about, you know, you mentioned your band in Seattle. Is it Sky Cries Mary?
Sky Cries Mary.
You know, we've mentioned that Alan McGee's club night on here quite a lot and how popular it was. And then just a story about when Dave Grohl walked in and everyone was staring at him, and then he picked you out because he loved your band.
Yeah, it was funny because at that time when I lived in London, it was right after Is the Sit came out. So I was used to being a little bit of a center of attention if I went into a nightclub. But everybody I was talking to like completely looked away from me because Dave Grohl had just walked in the room. And I didn't know Dave. I didn't know him. And I was just like, oh, well, there goes my fun tonight. But for some reason, he walked straight up to me. And I thought he was going to say like, congratulations on recording the Strokes album. But instead he said like, wow, that's Gordon from Sky Cries Mary, the best band in Seattle. And I'm like, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's quality. And then, yeah, just I've just got a list of things really, like good story about when you first got set up in a studio in New York and Ian Brown just rung you up out of nowhere.
That's right.
But you didn't notice him, right?
Yeah. I didn't know it was him until halfway through the first vocal take. Something about his voice. I knew that voice. He just said, my name's Ian. I live in the neighborhood, you know, and I wrote Ian's song on the Logic session. I'm listening to that voice and I'm seeing the name Ian. And I'm going like, wait a second. That's Ian Brown from Stone Roses. I'm recording him. He didn't even tell me. So I asked him, and yes, it was Ian Brown. He just walked in off to my studio, sight unseen.
Yes. Because, it's interesting that story about when you first got that studio, because were you getting like a salary for just being in there before you were actually recording other bands?
Actually, I wasn't getting a salary at first. I was spending the rest of my earnings that I made in Seattle during the grunge era from Sky Cries Mary's publishing and things like that. I was spending about $700 a month just to learn how to use the equipment in the studio and work on my own music. And then at a certain point at that studio, people started coming down and asking me to record them. And so there was this magic moment where it turned into a giant money hole of me wondering what I'm going to do in New York because I'm not making any money and I have no job, to like recording bands and getting paid for it. And it's kind of like became a job right then and there.
Then, yeah, obviously you talked about the fact, I mean, you live in England now, obviously, and
yes,
that you grew up and a lot of your heroes were actually British musicians kind of thing.
That's right. I always loved British rock and roll from the Beatles. And even someone like Jimi Hendrix, who was from my town, Seattle, he had to come over here to get kind of recognized and get his career going. And also the grunge scene from my town, Seattle, started really getting recognition in the UK. That's what put it from small clubs in Seattle to like a global phenomenon, was that Mudhoney and Tad and Nirvana were coming over here to tour at first, and it was a huge jumping off.
And I guess that's what happened with the Strokes as well, right? They kind of made it over here first.
Absolutely. We repeated history. The first place they got some attention was in the UK.
And then you obviously go into that first night of seeing the Strokes. I'm sure you've well rehearsed in talking about the story, but yeah, you're actually more impressed with another band that night.
Yeah, the first band that came on was really my cup of tea. Like, it was so good. They were like a British invasion band, but they were from America, and they had great harmonies and great songwriting, and I totally fell for them. And the Strokes was like, okay, yeah, they're pretty cool. I'll give both bands my card because I want to work. And the first band that I liked, they didn't come over to my studio, but a couple days later, the Strokes showed up, and we started working together.
And yeah, you said you've got some cool stuff still, like Albert's number on the back of your business card and stuff
like
that.
Yeah, I have. Because, I mean, I gave them my card, but then Albert said, hey, why don't you write down my number in case I lose your card, you know? So I wrote down Albert's number on another card, and I still have that one in my little collection of things.
And you got some of Julian's notes as well.
Yeah, I have some of his kind of handwritten lyrics. In my book, there's actually a picture of one of the pages. He gave me permission to use it. I thought he'd get upset that I, you know, because he left them at my studio, and I just, as I was moving out of that studio, I just found a pile of papers, and it's like, oh, there's the original lyric sessions from the Modern Age EP. I'll just keep these with my things. But he was very gracious about it.
And, you know, you talk about how kind of unique they were as a band in terms of how sharp they were and how understanding of each other they were, kind of how they communicated with each other.
Yes, the communication was extremely impressive, but the most impressive thing was how they played and how they rehearsed, and just the fact that they were not going to let anything go. Like, nothing was going to be good enough. It had to be right in every aspect, and I wasn't used to that from young musicians at the time. Most people were just like, it's not rocket science. It's close enough for rock, you know, like that kind of attitude. But these guys were meticulous about getting things correct.
Yeah, and like, I loved the way he described Julian's, the way he described things to you, described it as cryptic poetic ciphers.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which are great. And I love the fact you can remember like a lot of them. Like, do you have a favorite one of those?
I think he'd say things like, hey, you know the drum set? Well, it sounds like the whole drum set is at a party, but the toms can't get in. You know, they're sad. They're sitting on the sidewalk because they can't get in. Can you make it so they're all at the same party? Like, things like that.
Yeah, great. And yeah, it's interesting when you said Julian, like, you know, with most bands or every band that you worked with, the lead singer was always raring to go and record, but Julian was a bit different.
Right, right. All the singers are just basically waiting for the band to finish their track so they could prance out and have the spotlight shine on them and, you know, show everybody how great they are. And Julian was actually, like, reluctant. He took a big sigh and he walked out. And he didn't really want to do a sound check. He just wanted to, like, can we just start recording? I don't want to, like, do this. And it was like, I'm thinking, what is this attitude? You know, I'm not used to that. And it was very endearing after a while.
And you actually said you felt sorry for them because, you know, they had this great music, but you had seen things in magazines with like guitars and gravestones, and you're like, they're just not going to get heard, kind of thing.
I felt, yeah, when I first recorded them, the first revelation was, oh, you know, because I saw them live and I didn't think much of it. But in the studio, when I actually mic'd everything up and I heard the songs enough, I was going, this is super interesting. Like, I really like it. I can totally relate to this music. I'm glad I'm recording it. Look how serious they are about it. But it's too bad they're born like either 20 or 10 years too late, because nobody likes guitar music in New York. And from my friends in London, they also told me that clubs were shutting, gig venues were just shutting down en masse, and it wasn't a popular thing anymore. Acid jazz, house music, jungle, drum and bass, anything but like rock and guitar music was coming really into fashion at that time. So I kind of felt like, oh, it's a shame. Like, listen to that, how serious they are about what they're doing, but just the wrong time for that kind of music.
So obviously you could never have predicted the type of influence they would have.
No, I wouldn't even expect it that they would get like a deal or make a record. I thought that they would just continue playing these free admission rock and roll venues in the Lower East Side for a while and then like go to college eventually or something.
And then, yeah, we had some questions, so I'm going to try and like feed them in. But someone on Instagram called Ariant Kant was saying, who had the idea for the distortion on the mic? But that's your idea, right?
It was kind of my idea at first because I had been listening to industrial music all through the like 90s and early 2000s. That's when I time to make my own music. I was using a lot of drum machines and synthesizers and heavily distorted vocals because my favorite band was Skinny Puppy from Vancouver, Canada. And they had a process they invented called the shitalyzer, which made the voice actually sound messed up, completely messed up. And so when it came time to record Julian's voice for the first time, I said, hey, look at this cool sound. And I put the distortion on 10. I put the tube preamp he was singing on 10 just to destroy it. I thought that would be a good idea. And when he heard it, after he sang the song, he said, I hate that sound. That is just awful, really ugly sound. But what if you like dial it back a bit? He basically gave me some cryptic ciphers. You know, your favorite pair of jeans. That's what he used. He said, you know how comfortable those are? But they're not brand new. Can you do that with the voice sound? And okay. So instead of 10, maybe 4? And recorded him one more time, and it was like everybody in the room loved it, including JP, their guru.
Yeah, I was enjoying your description of JP. It was quite funny, like the things you come out with. One example, I think it was like, so it sounded like he would just like kind of sit on the couch, and then now and again he'd say something like, hey Gordon, why don't you cut out 100 hertz on Nikolai's bass and boost the kick drum at 1k? And right. You kind of didn't really understand what he was on about.
Well, the only reason, I mean, I've been recording for many, many years, but I never went into it technically. So I didn't know what 100k is or 1k. I just know that, it sounds dull. Let me pump up the treble. Let me pump up some high. I knew how to do stuff, but I didn't know the technical new number. I was never good at math. So numbers never entered my game. So when he would call these things out, it was like I would just roll my eyes and go like, I don't know what he's talking about, but I think he wants me to brighten it up. So I would do something and he'd go, yeah, that's great. Yeah, good.
And then Andy Douglas asked how much input did JP Bowerstock actually have on the songs? Like he heard that he wrote a lot of the music, but I don't know if that's true.
That's a very interesting question. I think it goes back a ways because I think he taught all the guys in the band. Like I think he taught Albert and Nick Valenci and Julian guitar. He was their teacher on guitar. So he laid the foundation for what they were able to do. And I guess Julian wrote a lot of the parts on the guitar. So I think that JP's contribution of raising these guys in this very proficient and high level of musical knowledge and ability, I would attribute that to some of his influence. And I actually saw Julian come up to him and say things like, you know, I was thinking of changing this solo. What would like someone in rock and roll, like in the 60s, what mode would they have worked in on this kind of chord change? And he would say, like Mixolydian, it's like these. And so Julian would say, oh, thanks. And he'd go away and come up with a solo based on some communications he might have had right then and there with JP. So that's what I know about.
Yeah, it's cool to hear that you actually wrote one of the lyrics as well for Barely Legal.
I think so, yeah. From the best of my memory, I was always waiting for the moment when Julian reads that book and calls me up and says, are you kidding me? But as far as I remember, there was a blank hole in one of the lines of lyrics and we needed to get it done. And he and I were bantering back and forth about possible ideas of what could fill it. And I came up with like, that's something that you learned yesterday. That was my rhyme for I don't show up on weekdays or something. And he said, yeah, okay, And so I think it was a very flippant, fast thing. And that's as good as I can remember. This is the truth.
Yeah, I never actually knew about the drums on Hard to Explain. Obviously, they always stood out as being, like, you know, just so meticulous. But
yeah,
there's actually kind of your technique of blending machine with Fab's drums.
Well, it wasn't really blending the machine. It was like they wanted to use a drum. Julian wrote it on a drum machine, and he loved the way the drum machine sounded and felt. And again, because of my experience with industrial music and having worked with drum machines for years and years, I already knew, hey, I can turn Fab's drums into a drum machine feeling and sound. Watch. So it's actually a drum set and Fab playing the drums, but I used industrial music techniques and some acoustic theory, and I made it sound like a drum machine so I could please Julian with the sound and not have Fab left out of a song on the first album.
Yeah, and you talked about how, you know, Fab would kind of grab you early before the studio.
Yeah.
And you go out for pizza with him, and then you go in early to, like, go over his parts. Is that right?
Yeah, he really wanted to make sure, without anybody in the room but him and me, wanted to listen closely to the drums to make sure that everything was the way he wanted it to be, and there were no, like, rushing and slowing down. And that was, it was very nice because I didn't know him very well, but through these kind of one-on-one meetings and having lunch together and coming into the studio and working with him, we developed a very nice rapport.
Yeah, so yeah, because you kind of said that, you know, you've been working with them for a while, but you didn't actually know them personally. So is it quite nice to have moments like that?
Yeah, it's nice to have moments like that, or later when I get to go see them before a show and have a chat. When you're in the studio and you're just working, you know, the music is priority and you're focusing on notes. You're not really like, so where did you grow up? And what kind of food do you like? You know, we never chatted about that kind of personal stuff. We just were like in the trenches together, which already is forming a very nice bond, because people's music and their art and their lyrics and everything are very personal. Like, it's very inner thing, and to be able to participate with someone and gain their trust is very cool.
Yeah, you really get a sense of that idea that, like you say, you're in the trenches together, especially when, you know, there's outside interference from the label.
Yeah.
And the A&R guy enjoyed reading it when he was like, how do we deal with this? And you're like, right, we're gonna let him in, and then he will let him say his ideas, and you were quite relaxed. You would just feed the back to the band and be like, nah, we don't agree.
I wasn't really relaxed.
Okay,
I was cooperative, because if I wouldn't have been cooperative, I could have been replaced with no questions asked. Like, the label just said, we're not going to put out your album, The Strokes, unless you get rid of this clown. But so, you know, we had talked ahead of time that if I was cooperative and I let him come in and kind of direct some of the production for a while, then maybe I had a chance to stay on the project.
Okay, all right. And I think he said he changed something by like one diameter or something.
I think he had many ideas that did not fly. And in the end, there was like a boost of a snare drum by a decibel in the chorus of Last Night. And that's what he got away with.
Yeah, you kind of forget how young the band were at that point. But you mentioned how self-aware Julian was in his lyrics. And some of the things you talk about, like, you know, very he knew his own opinion at a very young age kind of thing.
Yeah, they were very young. I think that Fab turned 21 during the Is This It recording sessions or something like that. I remember we had a birthday for him. But yeah, the music and the lyrics and the originality that was going on was far beyond their young age, I think. Their seriousness and their proficiency and everything.
Yeah, you talk about going to see them live at that during that time. I think maybe the residency that they got.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of a bit of a strange moment with Julian, because it's been between doing the demos and then before the album deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says something like, I bet you wish we'd sign something, or kind of thing, yeah. Was that a bit of a strange thing for you to hear at the time?
Well, he was fond of a few drinks before the shows. And he came up to me and he was giving me a giant hug. And I'm like, oh, right. You know, like, Julian, you know, it's great seeing you. These residencies are so exciting. And then he just came out with this thing about, like, aren't you sorry you never signed a contract with us? And it just kind of really dampened the mood, shall we say. And I swore at him. I told him to fuck off. And yeah.
And then was it the same night where, was it Nick pinched the girl you brought to the gig or something?
Yeah, it was like this another one of those shows. He didn't pinch her, not at all. I mean, he was just in the... I'm sure she approached him. I'm quite sure. But that's rock and roll.
And then, yeah, that moment when, you know, you think you've lost the album to someone else, and then you get the call off Julian. And before that, you had that... Was it a meeting you had with him at a restaurant or something where he actually walked out?
Yeah. You know, Rough Trade had signed them on the EP and suggested a very good record producer, like a historic British producer. And at one point, Julian just told me that if I told him right then and there over dinner that I was a better producer, then I would get the first album. And I'm thinking, I've sold zero records in my whole career. You know, I've got a lot of ideas. I think I'm very talented and I have a gift for music and production, but how could I say that I'm a better producer than a guy with a track record of selling 6 million albums of everything he's ever done? Like, come on, Julian, don't make me do that. And so because I wouldn't just say it outright that I'm better, I lost the record. You know, he stormed out of the restaurant very upset because he wanted to work with me, but they started the album with someone else.
And I thought it was funny when you got to the point of doing the second album, and I think that the idea was they were going to try someone else again. Mm-hmm. And Julian's comment something like, well, it'll just be classic us to sack a producer before we start or something.
Yeah, they started it with Nigel Godrich, the producer or engineer of Radiohead. And when I found that out, he could see I was crestfallen, like, oh no, I lost it again. You know, we have this track record. We just released Is This It? And now I'm being sacked again in favor of somebody else. It's like, man. And he said, well, don't worry. Maybe we just like to fire someone before we start a recording.
And then, yeah, just about you, your own career, you mentioned signing a bad contract with management. I was just interested in, like, what became of that? Were you able to get out of it at some point?
I can't really talk about it, to be honest, right, for legal reasons. But the truth of the matter is I signed a contract with someone that I really thought was going to help me, and I was very excited about it. And it turned out that I didn't get any kind of action or interaction with that person, and yet I was contractually obliged with them for many, many years, and it made me very angry because the money I was giving that person, I felt like I could put it into starting my own label or helping young bands that I was meeting, like, to record them and to help push their music. So it was a very upsetting experience, and yeah, but maybe I learned something from it. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite I felt quite frustrated for you, like, reading that as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Gram Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. We had Ryan Jarman on from The Cribs a while ago.
Right.
And he was saying how his side project was signed to Julian's label. And he was saying how, yeah, he's saying how meticulous Julian was as a producer. Like, he kept going over things again and again. And obviously you get a sense of that in the book, that he was like that with his own music, obviously.
Yes, yeah. I think he's his own hardest critic, which is why I think it's hard work for him to work on his own music, because he doesn't do anything in half measures.
And then it's interesting with the mastering, because I don't think many people know much about it. Your comment that it was a mastered song never sounds how like you've left it. Is that right?
There's a million possibilities during the mastering process for it to wreck the sound. You know, they might think, a lot of mastering engineers think that they're much smarter and more musically sensitive and have better ears, and they're just smarter than the producer, the band, the little musician, the guy who wrote the song. So like when they get something like, yeah, everyone knows for radio, you got to make it really bright. You know, you got to really brighten it up. And where's the bass? Let's boom it. Let's make that bass strong. But what if you have a song where you've purposely made the bass small because it's a sad song and the bass just sounds like it's like really lame because that's the emotion of the song. And this mastering guy just like pumps it up because that's how he thinks it should be without knowing, really feeling the song. And so there's a lot of things that can go wrong during the mastering process. I don't know how to master something. I know how to record, write, mix, all these things I can do, but mastering is kind of a black art. It's like right when you finished working on the song and you get it exactly perfect how you want it, either weeks or hours spent doing that, someone else is going to come along and make and change it in, right before the world gets to hear it. And the theory is that in the best case scenario, they can make song one the same volume as song two, so there's no shocking jump between the songs. And they can make it so that in a nightclub, when Kanye West's song comes on before yours, it doesn't make yours sound thin and horrible and tiny. So there's a lot of value to be had from mastering, but it's just a very tricky process.
Yeah, Julian actually said that to you at one point, didn't he? He's like, why does that, do our songs sound quieter? But you kind of realize it's because, I think he's, Nirvana was the example he used.
Yeah.
But you said it was like a different technique of playing kind of thing, basically.
Yeah, he asked me why their songs sounded smaller in a nightclub after a Nirvana song. And at first I thought, yeah, I'm not a very good producer, that's why. And then after a while, wait a second, you know, Kurt Cobain is playing these giant chords and, you know, doubling the guitar and making it really thick and fat. And you guys are playing single note or double note melodies and counterpoint. And it's not the same approach to making music. You guys' music is completely innovative and everyone loves it, but it's not the same compositional technique as a lot of basic rock and roll that has a big chord on one side and a little bit of melody going on the other side in between the vocals. Like, they had a completely different approach.
And then, yeah, going back to the mastering, I was like quite amazed at, when you're talking about the A&R guy's reaction to like Hard to Explain,
right,
which is probably, in my opinion, the best song on the album. But his reaction,
yeah,
you know, he just wasn't happy with it at all, which is just crazy.
He used the Hard to Explain was the very first song we mastered because it was going to be a UK single ahead of the album. So that was the first song we finished, and we sent it to Rough Trade for them to put on the radio and to do everything to promote the upcoming album. And when we got to this mastering lab, like, I tentatively pressed play to see what it was going to sound like in this alien environment. And to my delight, it sounded exactly like it did in our basement. Like, it was exactly, the mix was perfect. And I was very happy and relieved. And at that moment, the A&R guy just said, like, you hear that? That is the most unprofessional thing I've ever heard. Nobody's going to like that. You're killing your career if you release something that sounds like that. And the mastering engineer in that case agreed with him and said, like, why is there distortion on the vocals? Like, nobody will understand that. And it was a moment in time.
But then you had the band fighting in your corner kind of thing. Oh, you're fighting in each other's corners, yeah.
They did say that they liked it that way, and they did stand up because it was a group process. It wasn't my sound. It was our sound that we made together.
And then just the final moments of making that album, like going back to you and Fab again, like he was kind of, you had a bit of a panic attack, was it? And he kind of tried to help you through those final moments.
And that's a story that I haven't told very many times, and I've never said it in an interview. It's in the book, you know. I had this thing happen during the last night of working on Is This It that I haven't really talked about very much. But I think I went into incredible detail, like thought by thought. I basically had an incredible meltdown and panic attack which I was not used to have. Like, it came out of the blue. It was like the first one I ever had in that situation. And Fab kind of tried to help calm me down and bring me around. But it was awful timing because we had a lot of work to do before the band was about to go on tour.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you talk about having to take a break and, like, you vaguely remember some comments from the back room being like, you can't be serious, kind of.
Yeah. Are you kidding? Wait a minute. No. You're kidding me. You're kidding. What? Take a break? We have, like, a few hours to finish the album and we have a long way to go. It's not a time for a break.
And then, yeah, just the timing of, I think you said the same week, maybe, you finished the album, you actually got kicked out of your studio.
Yeah, during the last week of making the album, I had an eviction notice from my studio. They thought that I was being far too loud for the whole time I was there. But I told them I was going to be like a jet airplane taking off in the basement of that building 24 hours a day. That's what I told them before I even signed the lease. So it was a bit of a shame to lose that studio because it was quite cool.
Yeah, all the Strokes even wanted to recreate it, didn't they, for the third album?
Yeah, Room on Fire at a different studio in New York, they wanted similar decorations and lighting as what was in my old studio, and that's very endearing.
Yeah, and it's amazing how protective they were of that space as well. When they talk about the A&R guy, they're like, we can't have him in here. We'll have to just keep him out in the hallway or something.
Right. Yeah. It's our sanctuary. They called it their sanctuary. They didn't want, like, people from the music business coming in.
And you only got four Polaroids from that. Is that right? Was it a thing where they didn't want any of the documentation?
In those days, you know, it wasn't like we didn't have social media. So the idea of, like, sticking a camera in people's faces while they're trying to, like, learn their parts or perform the best of their ability was completely alien. So at the end of Is This It, there were a total of four Polaroid, maybe five Polaroid photos taken during those 7 weeks. And again, they left them there, so I think I'm the one that has them.
And then, yeah, just moving over to the UK side of things. Obviously interested to hear your kind of approaches from the Libertines and their manager. But I was enjoying your reaction to their initial demos. You felt quite offended by them.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you're asking me this because, first of all, Pete Doherty wrote a book. And I just happened to be in Rough Trade East in London, and I opened the book and went right to the page where, you know, just accidentally, where he's talking about this moment. Like, someone asked him, is it true that Gordon Raphael was going to do your own? And he said, like, I don't really remember. I think there was some vague talk about it. And even John Hassell, when he was on your show, he didn't remember exactly how that all worked. But the truth of the matter is that on two separate occasions, very early in their career, I was asked to be the producer. The first time was at the very same club party where I met Toby at Heaven, London, after the big Stroke show. I was sitting next to Banny, the manager, and Pete Doherty, and I got introduced to them, and they both asked me if I would listen to some demos and consider producing their album. And at that time, it was before they were on Rough Trade, and they had a completely different sound. And I don't know how to describe it technically. I was thinking about it today. And it's like some kind of traditional British folk music. It had a very old-timey spirit to it. And this was at a time when Pete and Carl were wearing suits and, like, playing mostly acoustic instruments. And, like, I kind of heard those demos, and I thought, you know, it's good, but it's not the kind of music I understand, or I don't know how I would improve it. I don't know what I would do, where my gift would come in here. So I just said, like, no, I don't think I want to record this. It's not exactly something I, you know, it's not in my expertise and my artistic knowledge. So I don't think I can bring something to the table here. And then a few months later, I had the chance to hear them again. And they had been signed to Rough Trade, and suddenly they were an electric band, really fast tempos and really dirty sounds. And I didn't like the demos that I heard. I thought they were highly derivative of the Strokes kind of recorded sound. But the next day after hearing the demo, I went to a rehearsal. This is before they had recorded anything like that was publicly released on Rough Trade, and before they'd even toured very much. And when I saw them play those songs, I thought they were phenomenal. Like, I thought this band is one of the greatest rock bands I've heard. I love their harmonies. I loved Gary's drumming. Like, everything about them ticked the boxes of, like, this is my next big band I'm going to record. And I said, yes, I want to record this. I want to be the producer. And I even went on their first tour, which was around the UK with the Libertines. And the Libertines were playing with The Vines most of the time, but The Strokes, they did a couple joint shows at some universities with the Strokes. And so, yeah, for a while there, I really thought I was going to be the producer of the Libertines.
And what happened in the end? Was it more of a label decision that they went
to someone else? I don't know what happened. I just, after a meeting with the label, they came back with kind of sad faces. You know, because we'd been kind of working together for 2 months and hanging out every day, and we were really getting ready to record. And they kind of said, like, Rough Trade aren't down with you recording our album. And I never know why. I don't know whose idea it was. I don't to this day know what happened, but that's how the story goes.
Right. Yeah, because you got a question from a guy called Brad Jack, who actually said he'd met you in Pontefract a few months ago.
Absolutely. Pontefract rocks.
But he said he forgot to ask you if you liked the end product that Mick Jones produced. Like, were you into that first album of the Libertines?
Well, I have my observation and my point of view is that by the time they actually got in the studio, I think they were a bit too, shall we say, for lack of a better word, messed up to actually play and sing their songs in the way that they had been doing at the very beginning when I saw them. Like, it was only, I think it took a while to record that album, maybe a year later it came out after they were signed. And in that time, it just seemed more like the graceful and powerful side of the music to me was obscured by the shambolic disarray. They really capitalized on that. It just sounded like very drunken, out of tuneness, too many layers of guitars that didn't need to be there. Like, this is my personal opinion. It's like, I never got to hear that group that I met early when they were first signed. I never got to hear a recording of that particular brilliance.
And then, yeah, you mentioned doing the sound for Libertines while they're playing with the Strokes, and it's just funny story of how Pete asked you to introduce him to Julian, and then yes, the next thing you saw, he was leaving 10 minutes later.
Yes, leaving in a hurry 10 minutes later. And I never found out why that was either, but I got told by Julian, never bring him back here again. Okay.
Yeah, there's some theories, I think, in the Meet Me in the Bathroom book.
I hadn't read those theories yet.
No, yeah, we'll leave them there anyway. But yeah, it sounds like you got to do, it's like a pretty exciting time to be in London, right? Like, you got to do some
absolutely
pretty cool stuff.
Absolutely. And lots of New York bands were coming through at the Metro Club and Water Rats and all these. There was lots of great, exciting nights of music in 2002 and 2003 when I lived in London, definitely.
Because you went to things like the Brit Awards and the NME Awards and stuff like that?
Yeah, right when the Strokes were being featured there, I got snuck in by their lovely security detail, Danny Yates.
Yeah, just other stories, like you mentioned becoming kind of acquaintances with Boy George, like he'd use his studio, yeah, and different things like that.
Yeah, one of the first, like right after I got kind of terminated working with the Libertines, I was very sad, but I was going out to clubs night after night, just trying to hang out and see music. And I met a group called El Hula, which was really an individual named Blair Jollins, and he was signed on a label run by Boy George. And after talking with him, I got hired by Boy George to record and work with El Hula, and we got to work for a while at George's mansion on Hampstead Heath. It was really beautiful, and he turned out to be extremely smart and very nice guy, very helpful, friendly. He even put out a compilation album of bands I produced on his label. So thank you, Boy George.
And then, yeah, you mentioned hanging around like the Libertines kind of crowd. You even lived with the Wolfman.
Yes.
Peter Wolf, like, what was that like as an experience?
I stayed with the Wolfman and his girlfriend for a while. Amherst Street or something Amwell Street. That's right, Amwell Street in Islington. And he was a very nice guy. He had a lot of strange and disappointed stories of his music career. And we shared an affinity for smoking, I think, hash or whatever you call it, gear. we were really into that together. By the way, if you don't mind, I'd like to say that we are talking about stories from my book. In case people don't remember that a lot of the questions you're asking me, I'm trying to really plug my book as much as I can. So I have a book called The World is Going to Love This, Up from the Basement with the Strokes. It just came out this summer, and I'd like everybody to get multiple copies, of course.
Yeah, I can thoroughly recommend this. I'd say it's essential reading for anyone that's into this podcast, to be honest. It's great.
Thank you.
Yeah, obviously I don't want to ruin all the stories.
That's fine. You can ask me anything.
Okay, great. Just a funny one about, it's kind of, with Johnny Burrell, it's always been a bit of, a bit of a myth about, or an unknown story about how much he was involved with the Libertines. But you kind of said there's a picture of him with the Libertines when you were there.
Right.
And there's just a funny story about him kind of trying to read some poetry at a party or something.
Yeah, actually Toby L. reminded me of that when I was forming the book. I was having chats with Toby about things he remembered. And when me and my best friend Anna Mercedes moved from New York to Islington in London, I got a big house because I had some royalties from the Strokes for the first time. And we started having parties to introduce everybody, hey, we're here, I want to meet musicians. And the Libertines were over a lot, and their friends, and the Filthy McNasties pub crew would come, and Johnny Burrell was always there, and he was always hanging around with the Libertines. And according to Toby, at this first introductory party we threw, suddenly the music was stopped by this young man, and he opens a book and he says, I'm going to read you one of my poems. And he started reading a poem and everybody started booing and they turned the music back on. And that was Johnny Burrell. That was him doing his routine. But they hung out all the time and they did shows together. And definitely everybody was friends in those days.
Yeah, and you mentioned kind of enjoying the London scene at that point, and you even got your own club night going. And but you just mentioned basically there was a good night every night of the week to go to, kind of thing.
Yeah, there really was. I went out almost every single night to some club or party or club night, concert. It was happening for sure.
But at the end, you kind of say that you weren't really taken with many of the, I suppose, indie bands.
Yeah.
That were around at that point. I think you mentioned Block Party, but
Block Party and Yeah Yeah Yeahs were examples of bands that I came across that I really liked. Were really blowing my mind. And I met a lot of young bands that I recorded that were very good, but by and large, the scene started to be kind of commercialized, and they would wear the skinny jeans and the Converse, but they would be on major labels and being kind of produced in a real radio-friendly, watered-down way, high production value. And I was going well, this isn't exactly my scene. After a while, I got really tired of what was going on, and I wasn't really included. After a while, I wasn't really recording lots of bands, and so that's when I moved to Berlin.
But just before that, I quite enjoyed how, these big London execs would invite you around.
Yeah.
So you just go for some free drinks at their offices, kind of thing. And then you try and introduce bands to them.
Yeah, I mean, the first time in my life, major label guy, presidents of A&R were calling me and inviting me through their secretaries to come meet them in their offices. And this was a lifelong goal. I'd always been completely ignored by these executives and their record labels. And so I thought, man, I'm going to meet these people. I'm going to show them what I've been doing and show them my music and other friends' music. And as soon as I walk in, big smiles, handshakes, cup of tea, please sign, is this it, for their teenage kids. Yeah, all done. So what have you been up to, Gordon? And I play them some, hey, listen, I've been working with some of the coolest bands in the world. Listen to these songs. And as soon as I played music for them, their eyes would like glaze over and they'd look sadly out the window or glance at their watch. And suddenly there was a 3 o'clock meeting that they had to go to, and sorry they had to rush, but it was great meeting me. It's like every time it was the same repeated scenario.
And then you're working with Regina Spektor, just sounded amazing, kind of like your reaction to her in the studio, just how kind of blown away you were by her. And I thought it was funny how, you know, you said you'd recommended music to Julian in the past and he played in music, but it was only when you played him Regina Spektor that he really kind of took notice, kind of thing.
Right. Well, there's like two stories there. The first one is that when I first met Regina Spektor, she played me one song. I didn't know who she was. I didn't know what she did at all. I just met her in a studio and I said, "What do you do?" She played me this song called Poor Little Rich Boy. And within 1 minute of listening to this, I actually got the title of my book. Like, I'm thinking, the world is going to love this. I have to record it right now. Like, we gotta put this out. This is incredible. So I became like instantly a fan of hers in halfway through one song. Okay. And when I'd finished recording the album, sometime 8 months later, I was in the same studio that I recorded her recording Room on Fire with the Strokes. And late at night, halfway through the summer, Julian was just passed out on a couch and we were talking about something. And I said, "Hey, do you mind if I play you something that I recorded?" And he gave me a very curious look, because almost every time I played him something that I was interested in or my own music, he just was like, would roll his eyes and like, "Take that off, take it off." But I thought, I'm going to play him Regina Spektor's album that I made with Regina. And I played one song and I was waiting for him to like get upset with me or tell me to turn it off or let's get back to work. But no, he said, like, "Play me another." And so I played another and he said, "Burn me a copy of this on CD, please." And I was like, whoa. When I tell Regina that Julian, you know, wants a CD to take home to listen to, this is like going to be huge news. And eventually, when Room on Fire was finished, they did a tour with Kings of Leon and Regina Spektor opening the show. So that was great for everybody.
And obviously when they recorded together and you produced that as well.
Yeah, they did one song that not everybody knows about that song. It was a B-side. It was a B-side of Reptilia for Room on Fire, and it was Regina and the Strokes together doing a duet. Beautiful song. I think it's called Modern Girls and Old-Fashioned Men. Very good, yes.
And you talked about putting together a video. I don't know if it's for that song or another song.
For that song, I worked with a director I'd been working with in London, Tim Mattia, and we made a video of the Regina Spektor with the Strokes song, hoping to sell it to the Strokes so they'd put it on MTV and we'd cash in. And as it turned out, they really liked the video, but they never wanted to go forward with it. And so occasionally when I'm doing talks or presentations nowadays, I will play that video for people just to, you know, have them see it.
Oh, really? I was going to say, can you see it anywhere? Yeah.
I've never really put it on YouTube or anything online because it's not my song and I respect their rights to it. But sometimes when I'm like lecturing at the Pontefract Public Library, for example, only a couple months ago, I had a video screen and I played that.
Okay, I did see you. I came to one of your talks at Dingwalls in Camden.
You did? Oh, that was a rare one.
About 7 years ago now, yeah. But I can't remember if you played that or not. I don't think you did.
I don't know if I did. I would have thought I did. I showed lots of slides and talked. I did a UK talking tour about 7 years ago, and yeah. Dingwalls was the London venue. It was fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, then just moving on to Room on Fire. And it sounded like quite a cool setup that you said Julian would be recording his vocals sat next to you, which sounded good.
Yeah, that was very, very fun. I mean, I didn't expect that. I thought he'd be out in the big room, but he wanted to sit next to me. We both wore headphones, and he sang every song on the album just right there in a chair next to me.
Then, yeah, like a story about Damon Albarn walking in after a Blair show. Some of the quotes in that are very funny.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if he'll ever read that.
Yeah, I'll let people read that, but yeah, that was great. But he actually tried to record harmonies at one point, which sounded quite disastrous.
I can actually say, he might not remember it, but I recorded Damon Albarn singing for an hour one night during the recording of Room on Fire, and none of the vocals stayed on the tracks, which I'm glad about.
Was it like multiple songs he was just trying then?
I think it was one or two songs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously the 1251 sound. Is it Nick's guitar?
Yes.
Was that another thing where you, techniques that you'd picked up to get that sound?
Yeah, that was one of the very few times I actually kind of had a crazy idea. Usually I would just like kind of get sounds that they liked and make sure that they were comfortable when they recorded and then interact with them about everything. But in this case, when I heard that guitar sound, I had an idea and I said, that sounds a lot like my synthesizer, my ARP Odyssey synthesizer. Like, it sounds so close in tone, but my synthesizer has two oscillators. And if I was playing that on my keyboard, I would detune the oscillators a little bit to get this really fat sound. So I suggested that he go out and detune all his guitar strings just a touch, just micro touch the tuning pegs until the strings were a little lower. And then play the riff again, and then indeed, it just sounded exactly like this really, it just like kind of doubled the size in a really alive and moving way, and I think people really liked that sound. I know that he liked it.
Yeah, it's great. And then, it's interesting reading about you talking about the reaction to that album, because, like you say in the book, a lot of people see that as a favorite album, and if I was going to listen to a Strokes record, it probably would be that one, for whatever reason. But yeah, why do you think it was received differently? Had some theories about maybe you comparing it to different bands kind of thing that had happened before maybe.
Right. I have two theories about why at the time that Room on Fire came out, there wasn't the same kind of public outcry of support. There wasn't just an overwhelming support for it. And my theory is that it does sound like the Strokes. It has that Strokes sound, okay? And the first time that the world ever heard that sound, it was a brand new concept. So people went crazy for it. The second time they heard it, it could have been better songs and more time spent on the recording, but they'll never capture that first time that you hear a certain sound feeling. So it was like, oh yeah, that's cool, but we know this sound. We know this. And so I think we lost the element of the surprise factor. That's one reason. And then, in my view, they were not as keen to tour as they were on the first album. It was like, we're going to see the world. We've never toured out of the U.S. before. We've never even toured the U.S. before. So they were really excited, and they found themselves on a 2-year tour of the world, going over and around in Japan, Australia, Europe, back to America, back to Europe. It was crazy, that 2-year period for Is This It? And I think they learned that, yeah, we had a lot of fun. We partied a lot. Fab broke his wrist. Julian was on crutches for part of that. I think they went for it, right? And I think by the time the second album was ready, they just wanted to, let's just play some important, festivals and do some touring, but let's not kill ourselves like we did on the first one. And I think that had a reaction of like, they certainly don't come here as often as they used to, or we haven't seen them for a while. What, are they ignoring us? So I think they got a kind of a negative reaction from not knocking themselves out on tour.
Like with the third album, they had like a permanent studio set up kind of thing. So it's a bit more of a slower process, it sounded like, for you.
Right. Well, first of all, they had me build a studio for them in their practice room, so they didn't have to have the feeling of paying by the hour for studio time. And the reasoning for that was that they had done a lot of touring that summer, and they hadn't written all their songs out, and they wanted time to develop their songs in a studio situation. And then when they had all the songs ready, then record the album properly. So the reason it was a long time, I would think I was there for most of a year just during the songwriting process, not even producing the album.
Yeah, he talks about obviously recording a lot of demos. I just wondered if they existed anywhere.
I'm sure they exist in some hard drives of the Strokes, but I don't have those. And I actually imagine that some of them are online or were released here and there because a lot of stuff that I didn't even know existed, you know, concerts, bootlegs, home recordings of theirs, you can find them online.
This just comes from Hannah Fair Adam, and she says, what's the favorite Stroke song that you worked on?
I have a few. I would say that I really love that song, Trying Your Luck. Right now, that's like my favorite from Is This It? And I've always loved the song Under Control from Room on Fire. Like, I think those two are extremely magical.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about Under Control. You said it's quite... Was it emotional, the word you used when you first heard it or something? Or
Yeah. It's a very unusual song for them. Like, it just has a completely... It sounds like this classic old-time song. And the way that the band blended in the room, like, they're all playing that music at the same time. It's just the way the room sounds. It sounds really wobbly. It sounds really kind of like... It sounds like it's in motion and moving around in a very strange way.
Tadaphne Antiques says, is it true Julian is the best guitarist in the Strokes, or is it just a cool rumor?
Well, to be honest, I don't think I've ever really heard Julian play guitar. I know that he probably composed a lot of our favorite songs on the guitar, but I think Albert and Nick Valenci are phenomenal, great guitarists.
Yeah, I was going to say it'd be... Hard push to be better than those two, I think.
Right.
Then William Han says, whose idea was it to get rid of the incredible solo from the demo version of Barely Legal?
That's so funny, because someone else brought that to my attention. And I had to admit, I didn't even notice it going away. I didn't even notice it till someone like last week said, why did they cut that solo out? Now, I guess when I thought about it, like, it wasn't, nobody announced it to me. It was just, what are we recording next? Or we're doing Barely Legal, an album version, okay? So I think I was just so involved in recording it that I didn't really, what happened to that solo we did 7 months ago or something like that? I don't think I thought that. But I can imagine that if they're recording 11 songs, they go like, we can't have a guitar solo in every song, so... Which song's guitar solos are the best? And so I think it was probably, this is my hypothetical viewpoint, maybe they just trimmed it out because of all the solos they wanted to put on the album, that's the one that they cared for the least.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stories about your own band and your own label, which people can read about in the book, but some interesting stuff there for sure.
Shoplifter Records, yes.
Yeah, good name, yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
And it's interesting about... your band called Crystal Radio, because I was like, oh, that's a cool name, and there's obviously a story where you weren't allowed to use it kind of thing.
Yeah, because my dad and my grandfather were really into Crystal Radios. Like, they had these rooms set up, like I have my studio room set up, they had their radio room, so they'd go in there after work and they would dial and listen to radio broadcasts and talk to people through their radios around the world. It was like, you know, it was really cool. So I wanted to call my band Crystal Radio. And I did a few shows under that name, and I was about to make an album under that name when I got called by Ray Davies from The Kinks, saying that he had a band with his son called Crystal Radio, and we better cease and desist if we didn't want a nasty lawsuit. So I had to give it up.
The new name was quite good, though, I thought.
Black Light?
Yeah, I quite like that as well.
Yeah, it was interesting, because in U.S., we call what you call UV light is what we call black light. So I grew up with a black light in my room and these day glow posters. And, you know, we would get high and just like sit and look at the artwork glowing on the walls. And I didn't realize, I was in London and my band was all British, that people didn't really know what black light meant. It just sounded like some obscure like reference.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about your relationship with the Strokes, because obviously you didn't end up recording... Oh, producing the third album.
Right.
But watching the episode you did with them and reading the book about your relationship with them, you obviously still have a really good relationship and you're going to see them quite a lot.
Yeah, well, I'm very grateful that they came into my life, and they're very happy because a lot of things in their life changed when we made the Modern Age EP and Is This It and Room on Fire. So there's a general feeling that we respect and we like our past, and the fact is that after 20 years of them being the limelight and me kind of getting lots of work and publicity off the back of working with the Strokes, that we haven't taken each other to court. So, you know, that says a lot right there. I just saw them in Glasgow 2 months ago, I think in July. And, you know, hanging out with them is a very friendly feeling. And I gave them copies of the book. In fact, I don't know if they'll read it, but it was fun handing it to them.
I'd like to ask people if they would do anything differently about their career. You've mentioned a couple of bad contracts you signed in the book. But is there anything that stands out?
Yeah, maybe I wouldn't have signed some of those bad contracts. I don't know. I had to learn everything that I learned, and I was always following my own way, and I thought it was very important that I follow a path of music in my life and try to make music and be with musicians and learn to record. And so I can't complain. I'm very pleased with what's happening right now. I'm still doing it. I'm still making my own music. I'm still recording and producing bands. I feel chipper, healthy, happy, glad to be in the UK right now. So I'm glad I made the decisions I did.
Okay, great. And then, yeah, with the book, where's the best place for people to buy it?
Well, there's lots of places to buy it. It's easily available on Amazon and Rough Trade online. There's places. And if you go to my Gordotronic website, you can find it there. And it's more expensive because if you live in America, I have to mail it from my house here in UK. But I can write personal inscription and little jokes and put a sticker in it and things like that. So many places to find it. And it's even available on Kindle as an ebook. Someday maybe there'll be a spoken audio book of it if I can sit down for that long and do it.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah, that's it, Gordon, really. I really appreciate that. That was excellent.
Thank you very much.